Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the Acura TL with Bluetooth phone connectivity. Learn more at Acura.com.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. After his loss in the Aussie Open semifinals, Roger Federer's Grand Slam title count stands at 12, but he still has a shot at Pete Sampras, who holds the record with 14. Ahead on Only a Game, an appreciation of Roger Federer. Also an Aussie Open update, the Trailblazers put Portland back on the map, and a conversation with Baylor head women's basketball coach Kim Mulkey. Also ahead, powerlifter Anderson Wise recalls how his foster parents helped him grow strong in spite of his spina bifida.
My upper body, you know, is pretty big now, and part of that it has to do with, you know, having to crawl up the downstairs to where I get to my room every day. My other brothers and sisters slept on the second and third floor, so, hey, you know, I had to figure out a way to get up there myself.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Maria Sharapova never lost a set in her march to a third Grand Slam trophy. She beat three of the top-ranked players in her procession through the Australian Open, finishing the triumph by beating Anna Ivanovic in the final last night, 7-5, 6-3. The result demonstrates that Sharapova has put behind her the shoulder and wrist injuries that hampered her last year. If it was a surprise that the women's final featured the players who'd been seeded number 4 and 5 in the tournament, it is a considerably larger surprise that the men's final, which will be played tomorrow, will not involve Roger Federer, who has been a dependable presence in the Grand Slam finals for years. Federer was upset by Novak Djokovic yesterday in straight sets. Joining me now from Melbourne to talk about that result, among other things, is Bonnie D. Ford, who writes about tennis and other matters for ESPN.com. Bonnie, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks so much, Bill. It's great to be with you again.
This tournament is more a story of who's not in the finals. Roger Federer lost to Novak Djokovic yesterday in straight sets. Federer said afterward, "I've created a monster that I need to win every tournament." Still, the semifinals isn't bad. I was still quoting Federer when I said that. Was this loss an anomaly, or was it time for Djokovic to finally unseat his rival?
Everyone watching Federer these last 10 days remarked that there seemed to be just a little bit less zip to his game. Some people thought it might be because he had a very serious stomach ailment that sent him to the hospital right before the tournament. Preparation might have suffered, but he's not the type to make excuses. So it may just be that he finally ran into a bit of a down patch, which would not be an anomaly in the sense that you couldn't expect his incredible form to last forever. He's essentially gone 3 years without a serious injury. He is only 26, and it's not nearly the end. He's got a whole season in front of him, and I think this has a chance to probably poke the stick in the lion's cage a bit, and if I were the rest of the field, I would look for him to come roaring back.
Djokovic will face the suddenly hot Joe Wilfried Tsonga in the final. Tsonga came into this tournament unseeded, but the Frenchman has wowed crowds with some spectacular wins, including a straight set domination of number 2 Rafael Nadal in the semifinals. Who comes out of the finals a champion?
Boy, that's a great question, Bill. And if betting weren't such a sensitive topic in tennis right now, I would say that money would be pretty evenly split, if only because Tsonga was so overpowering in that performance. I think people might wonder if he can possibly come back after that, what was essentially a perfect match against a top player. Djokovic has played in a Grand Slam final before. He does have more experience at big moments, but he also has more to lose in that he's higher ranked and people expect him to win. And they've never played each other. So I think we'll see a final that might start out a bit herky-jerky, where they're both feeling each other out. Joe Wilfried has already done so well just to get where he's gotten that I think he probably will be able to swing a bit freer, especially at the beginning of the match.
I want to return to Federer for a minute because he's been so dominant for such a long time. He's still on a pace to surpass the 14 Grand Slam wins, the record held by Pete Sampras. In fact, he could do that this year. Is that your anticipation?
Well, again, it would take him doing something that he's never managed to do, which is to win the French Open. And he's been a finalist twice. It's not as if he's a bad player on clay. It's just that he's always run into the immovable object of Rafael Nadal, who actually moves extremely well if you've seen him play on clay. Can he do it? Yes. Says a lot that he's playing against history, and that might sound really pompous if anybody else said it, but he says it with such sort of grace and modesty that you can tell that he's saying he's got on his mind, you know, trying to achieve this feat that no one thought would be done really for quite a while. I think after Sampras put it out there, he, of any athlete in this sport and maybe any sport, is somebody that can handle that pressure and wants it and feeds off it.
Bonnie, over the past 2 weeks, tennis officials have tried to keep the focus on the game and not the continuing gambling scandal, but just this week, Indian tennis authorities launched an investigation after a doubles specialist from that country said that he'd been asked to lose a match for money. Do you get the sense that there's still more to learn about the involvement of gamblers in tennis?
Well, I do, Bill. I think that once the cover got ripped off Pandora's box last year when the investigation was announced into the match between Nikolai Davidenko of Russia and Martín Argüello-Bassolo of Spain, people, I don't think, even within the industry, and I've been told this by some of the top people on both the men's and women's tours, did not appreciate the amount of money that was being bet on tennis matches and how much it had grown in the last decade because of, obviously, the rise of internet betting in particular. So to everyone's credit, you know, the major organizations in tennis are trying to move on this now, but they're sort of playing catch-up. The trail was very, very cold. One of the things that the tour has become very aware of is that maybe they could be a little bit more careful about who they credentialed, who they allowed close to the players. Is it ultimately controllable? Probably not totally, but there's steps in the right direction.
Bonnie, you've also covered professional cycling extensively, and you've commented on the doping scandal that has scared away sponsors from that sport and put it in jeopardy. Could the gambling scandal pose a similar threat to the sport of tennis?
I really, really doubt it, unless there's a dark underbelly that's about to be ripped open that none of us know about. The prevailing conventional wisdom is that most of the players who have been approached, again, have been sort of lower-ranked players. And all in all, the top players that I've spoken to on and off the record have told me they do not really think that it's a pervasive problem. And the corporate money in the sport has never been better, frankly. So unless, again, there's a big scandal that is about to break that none of us knows about, I doubt it.
Bonnie D. Ford covers tennis and cycling for ESPN.com. Bonnie, thank you very much for joining me.
Bill, my pleasure.
The Portland Trailblazers were defeated by the visiting Houston Rockets last night, and the team's record now stands at 25-18. As Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor reports, that loss was the latest dip in Portland's 2007-2008 thrilling roller coaster ride.
The second pick in this year's draft will go to the Seattle Supersonics. And that means the number one pick will go to the Portland Trailblazers.
And with that, the number one pick was set to come and remove forever the remnants of the so-called Jailblazers. The Blazers are the only major pro sports team in Portland. Fans have been in love with them since the 1977 squad won the title with an upset of the Philadelphia 76ers. At one point, the Blazers made the playoffs 21 years in a row. Things were great in a place fans called Rip City until the late 90s. Then, the Blazers started a near-decade-long pattern of signing players that won games but couldn't keep out of the police blotter. It wasn't long until the team earned the nickname the Jailblazers from the media and the hatred of a fan base that once loved it. John Canzano is a columnist for the Oregonian.
Yellow Hummers, pit bulls, aluminum foil around marijuana trying to get through the metal detector in Tucson. It seemed like there was almost an incident every couple weeks with this team. And when it really got bad was when they stopped being competitive on the court, because not only was the community up in arms over what was happening off the court, but suddenly you couldn't justify it or rationalize it on the court.
The low point was the 05-06 season when the Blazers finished last in the division. A team that once enjoyed 814 consecutive sellouts was last in the league in attendance.
With the first pick in the 2007 NBA draft, the Portland Trail Blazers select Greg Oden from Ohio State University.
After Portland picked number one in last June's draft, 6,000 Blazer fans packed Pioneer Courthouse Square in downtown Portland to greet new center Greg Oden like he was a rock star. The Blazers already had a talented core of players, including 2007 Rookie of the Year guard Brandon Roy. Oden was going to bring back Rip City and Portland's first championship in 30 years. And then, disaster. Weeks before this season began, exploratory surgery revealed a major problem requiring season-ending surgery. And suddenly, the most anticipated rookie year in Blazer history was ruined before training camp began. The team started off 5-12, and it looked like it was going to be a long year without Oden to save them. But then, the Trailblazers decided to save themselves. Since that start, the team has gone 20-6, a stretch that includes a 13-game winning streak. Canzano explains how the team turned things around.
You've got players who aren't normal young players. Now, the Blazers are the youngest team in the NBA, third youngest team of all time in the NBA, but their young guys are Brandon Roy, who is not a typical second-year player. He plays like a veteran player. He's not normal. LaMarcus Aldridge, same thing. He's not a second year. He's not a sophomore. Really, he looks more like a third, fourth, fifth year player maturity-wise. I would argue that this team is more mature than the teams that they had in the last three or four or five seasons that were older and more experienced.
Head coach Nate McMillan has his own theory about this team's success.
Just great coaching. No. You know, what we try and do with our guys is just keep it simple. We don't try and give them too much information, and we try to focus on the game in front of us. Just play a solid game from start to finish.
That approach has pushed the Trailblazers into a close Northwest Division race with the Denver Nuggets. But they have a ways to go before they can seriously compete with the league's elite, as evidenced by last week's 10-point loss to the Boston Celtics. The Blazers turned the ball over 21 times and looked jittery. Afterwards, Brandon Roy sat in the visitors' locker room and pondered what happened.
You know, they bullied us tonight. I mean, they got after us tonight. They got in our face. They pushed us around. And we can't let this be a carryover effect. We got to make sure we come to practice and we go hard tomorrow. We've been playing to win lately, and I just think tonight we came in to give them a good game. And I think next time we play them, we got to believe that we can beat them.
Canzano thinks the bullying should stop once the 7-foot Oden takes the court for the team.
The one hole that it has, the glaring hole, is they need a big man who can defend and rebound. They don't even need him to score. And I think Greg Oden is probably sitting pretty in a nice position. I expect, if he recovers fully, that the Blazers will play deep in the playoffs in the next 5-6 years.
Fans seem to think the same. The team is 11th in NBA attendance this year. If Oden and his cohorts can make those deep playoff runs, then maybe Blazer Mania can finally return to Rip City. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. 25 years ago, a tourist from the United States visited the Frank Aston Underground Museum, since closed in Queensland, Australia. His name is Peter, and he must have liked some of the Aboriginal artifacts he saw in that museum. He stole a boomerang. Last week, the mayor of Mount Isa, where the museum was located, received a package and a note. The note read, "I removed this back in 1983 when I was younger and dumber. It was the wrong thing to do. I'm sorry, and I'm returning it." And so sometimes boomerangs really do come back. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Kim Mulkey's got the Baylor Lady Bears roaring again. Gee, I love that kind of talk. But first, I'm joined by Michelle Smith of the San Francisco Chronicle for a discussion of some of the women's college basketball teams that are even better than Baylor. Michelle, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
Each time we get ready to discuss women's basketball, everybody in the Only a Game office tries to figure out how to avoid talking about the team from the University of Connecticut. Can you help us out here?
You know, there's kind of no way around the Huskies,
nope,
is there?
Nope.
They are, you know, I mean, I think for most of the year they're the, you know, been the best team in the country. They've had a couple of injuries. They had two ACLs, which we know is just a bad word in women's basketball. And, you know, but yet they got a big win over North Carolina. I mean, they really are the best team probably in the country right now. Hard to avoid them.
This week, for the third week in a row, undefeated UConn was unanimously voted the number one team in the country. They play Rutgers a week from Tuesday. Rutgers is off to a very strong start in the Big East and elsewhere. The game is in New Jersey. Any chance UConn loses that one?
Yeah, I think so. I think Rutgers is a very good team, you know, and it's within the conference. And, you know, we're having a conversation out here. We have Stanford and Cal playing. It's the first time those two teams have played as top 10 teams. But when you're playing a team in your conference, they know you so well. And, you know, I think, you know, Rutgers would absolutely have a shot at that because they've played Connecticut plenty of times and they certainly know what they're dealing with.
Well, I want to get to some of that California talk.
Let's talk West Coast basketball.
Well, we're going to work our way there. Tennessee is the number two team in the nation, but they have lost a game. Stanford beat them last month. But earlier this month, Stanford lost back-to-back games to fellow Californians UCLA and USC.
Unranked UCLA.
Absolutely. And as you say, the rematches of those games are coming up.
Yes.
How important are those games to Stanford?
They're pretty important. Stanford, you know, they're ranked number seven. They were number two in the country for a couple of weeks after that Tennessee win. They have three wins over top 10 teams this year. They're 3-1. The loss they had was at Connecticut and the Virgin Islands. They beat Rutgers at Rutgers. They beat Tennessee at home. And they blew out Baylor. I mean, just blew them out in Palo Alto. So they have played really well, and it's really sort of unfortunate that you go on the first conference road trip and they didn't play well. I was at both of those games, you know, and they come home with a sweep, and all of a sudden everybody's wondering what's wrong with Stanford. And honestly, there's not much wrong with Stanford. They had a pretty yucky weekend down in Los Angeles, and they've got to sort of atone for it, I think, the rest of the way.
Is yucky a technical term?
Yes, it is. technical basketball term. Tara Vandeveer probably has other adjectives for it, but we'll leave those out of it.
When the locker room door is closed, she probably does. Speaking of Stanford, you wrote recently about Sharman Smith, the former Stanford player and assistant coach who's now the recruiting coordinator at the University of California at Berkeley. She told you that she left Stanford because she wanted to see what it would be like to help build something rather than ride along with a program that was already very successful.
Yes.
I wonder how often the best players coming out of high school can be convinced to think it would be more fun to build something than go to UConn or Tennessee.
Not that often. You know, the kids that Cal brought in, they had this recruiting class 3 years ago with, it was two kids from Oakland Tech right down the road from Berkeley. The other, Ashley Walker, was from Modesto, about, you know, 50, 60 miles east of the better part of the Bay Area. They had local kids who not only, you know, felt like they could build something, but wanted to stay close to home. And it was like a lightning in the bottle moment. But Cal has made the most out of having this opportunity to have these great kids in. You know, they're 17-2. They are number 8 in the country, which is their highest ranking ever. I've watched them play quite a few times as well, and they are as confident and capable a basketball team as I've seen this year, you know, and that includes Stanford. That game is going to be a tremendous amount of fun because, you know, it's got a rivalry thing. Plus, these are two very good basketball teams.
You had an intriguing semantics situation in the Pac-10 conference as a result of a game last Saturday between UCLA and USC. Three players were ejected from the game for fighting,
yes,
except that the powers that be later decided that they were actually skirmishing, not fighting, which meant that they wouldn't be suspended. Now, what exactly is the distinction between a fight and a skirmish on the basketball court?
Well, I'm pretty sure there was a little pushing and shoving, and the kids that got ejected were all kids that came off the bench.
Mm-hmm.
One of the USC player that was ejected is Jackie Jamelos, who was out for her second year with an ACL tear and has not played at all. And isn't going to play anytime in the near future, and two kids from UCLA who came off the bench, and they were thrown out for coming off the bench. The altercation, there was an elbow, and two players got tangled up, and people sort of got themselves all excited at the end of the game. But my understanding of what happened was a little pushing and shoving, but no punches being thrown, no wrestling anybody to the ground. So I guess Pac-10 looked at it and said, well, that was a lot to do about not a lot, and we'll just, let everybody sit with the punishments they got at the end of the game.
So what you're telling me now is they weren't fighting and they weren't skirmishing, they were altercating.
Yeah, like that. Exactly.
Nebraska beat number 21 Texas A&M by 13 on Tuesday night behind Danielle Page's 25 points. Nebraska's won 6 of their last 7. Any other unranked teams making enough noise so that we ought to be paying attention to them?
It's hard when you're in the – because, in the land of the unranked, sometimes you've been ranked and then you've lost a game or two and you go back to the unranked and that. I mean, Nebraska is – Nebraska's a great story, but the Big 12 is wild. I mean, Oklahoma State taking it to Oklahoma and, Texas A&M is in that mix. And, Oklahoma's got Courtney Paris and somehow they're not ruling the Big 12 this year because they don't have quite the supporting cast that I think they need to make more progress. But the Big 12 is a great conference, and for Nebraska to be doing well – I think they should be busting into the rankings pretty soon. Kansas State has had its moment, where it's gotten a look in the rankings because it had a couple of big wins. Big 12 could have maybe 9 or 10 teams in the tournament at the end of the year.
Michelle Smith writes about women's basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle, and she joins me from time to time to talk about same. Thank you, Michelle.
You're welcome.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Kim Mulkey, the coach of the women's basketball team at Baylor University, is accustomed to winning. She's won the NCAA championship as a player, an assistant coach, and a head coach. In a new book with Peter May, Won't Back Down, Mulkey discusses not only triumphs in her career, but various losses and disappointments as well. Kim Mulkey joins me now from KWBU in Waco, Texas. Coach Mulkey, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you for having me.
You were celebrated as a player in high school, and you played for Louisiana Tech and won 2 NCAA championships. But as a player, you were sure that you never wanted to be a coach. Why?
I guess because I thought that the business world, the corporate world, would make more money, and it was just not the thing to probably want to do is be a coach. I'm certainly glad that I am where I am. This is what I'm meant to do, and I'm very comfortable with it. And I think it was just getting away from the game when I finished working at Louisiana, or when I finished my undergraduate degree at Louisiana Tech and finished the Olympics. I just had a business degree. My master's was going to be an MBA in obviously in business, and I just thought that traveling in the corporate jet sounded a little bit more lucrative than being a basketball coach.
Well, what changed your mind?
Actually, the president at the time at Louisiana Tech University, his name is F.J. Taylor, approached me when the head coach, Sonja Hogue, resigned, and he wanted to promote Leon Barmore to the head coaching position, but he wanted me to be on Leon's staff, and he approached me, actually had the campus police come get me out of class to meet him in his office. And I was convinced by Leon, more so than the president, that he really wanted me on his staff, and thank goodness they talked me into it.
Lots of coaches have said that recruiting is the most unpleasant part of their jobs. You acknowledge in the book that having your job depend in part on whether you can convince 17 and 18-year-olds to choose your program over others is stressful at best. Tell me a little bit about the challenges of recruiting.
Well, I think the recruiting, meeting people is wonderful. getting to know so many people and personalities, that's not the hard part. The hard part is rejection. And if you're in this business, you're going to be rejected. The best programs get rejections. No one likes rejection. And yet at the same time, recruiting is the lifeblood of all programs. And I think that's why coaches will quickly tell you that if it was all about X's and O's, we'd be in the business for a lifetime. But the recruiting stresses you. It puts too much pressure on you. You just can't handle 17- and 18-year-old young people telling you one day they're coming to play for you and the next day going somewhere else. And it's very difficult, and you have to just continue on and maintain focus when you are rejected and go to the next player.
Did winning the national championship in 2005 change the dynamic of recruiting at Baylor? And boy, does that feel like a silly question.
Well, winning, period, whether it's a national championship or not, continues to change the dynamics of recruiting. Yeah, the more you win, the more homes you can get into. And we're now at a level where we can get into homes. It doesn't make recruiting easier. People think because you win these national championships, you should be able to go out and get who you want. There may be two programs, Tennessee and Connecticut, that can do that because the longevity of how long they've been doing it. But the rest of us, we still have to work as hard as the guys that are climbing the ladder to trying to win a national championship.
You write with great affection about the family that provided a home away from home for you when you were playing at Louisiana Tech. Now the NCAA rules prohibit schools from providing players with that particular perk. Was life better for players in the not-so-long-ago good old days?
It was better in the sense that you didn't have as many rules. I don't know that it was better in what is provided. More television coverage, more resources, better facilities nowadays, whereas back then it was the little things that made you happy. Being able to have a home-cooked meal at someone's house. Nowadays you can do that only on an occasional basis. I think that we have gotten so bothered by the breaking of NCAA rules that we've had to make some really stern rules that don't really make any sense, but they've been abused so much through the years that now you can't do that anymore. And it was a wonderful program. It was like what you call a foster parent program for you away from home. And when I arrived at Louisiana Tech, we were all assigned a family to take care of us. And it wasn't that you lived at their home and or anything like that. You just did it on an occasional basis. And then some of us became really close to those families. And then the NCAA took over in 1982, and we had to do away with that program. Well, how do you now sever a relationship because the NCAA tells you you can't be friends with somebody? So I maintained that relationship within the guidelines of the NCAA rules. And then, of course, when I was finished playing, those people are still just like my family. We talk on an occasional basis and stay in touch. And it was a good thing, and I hate that we are at the point we are today with not being able to do things like that, because particularly on the women's side, and I'm sure it is on the men's side, young people get homesick. When you're away from home, you need someone away from the coaching staff and away from your teammates that can just hug you and cook a meal for you and just talk to you. And now you're so paranoid to do anything with boosters, and you just can't do those things anymore.
We see these players on TV, and we marvel at their skills, of course, and the amount of work they put in to get as good as they have become, and we forget that they're kids.
They really are, and we get so caught up in what they do for our university that we forget to take care of them sometimes. On the men's side, the money that is made through tournaments, and we're constantly thinking of ways to stay within the guidelines of rules and what can we do, what can't we do. All they want is a hug sometimes, and all they want is a home-cooked meal and someone to do their laundry for them.
My guest is Kim Mulkey, the head coach of the women's basketball team at Baylor University, and you're listening to Only a Game. You express your admiration in Won't Back Down for two men coaching men's teams. The two coaches are Bob Knight and Bill Belichick. Why those two?
Well, I don't know if I wrote that they my admiration for them. I spoke in the book, or I talked in the book about meeting them and a phone conversation that I got from Coach Knight. I don't know them on a personal level, but in my winning the national championship, I ran into Bill Belichick at the ESPY Awards, and he and I jogged together on treadmills one morning in Los Angeles, and we carried on a conversation for an hour and a half on a treadmill as if we'd known each other a long time, and it was all about football, basketball, athletics, our children. And I think it's just the common bond of coaches just can pick up with each other and talk the same language. Bob Knight, he was the 84 coach for the men's Olympic team, and I was on the 84 Olympic team, and I met him briefly there, and then he called me after the national championship, months after the national championship, and who wouldn't pick up the phone and just engage in a conversation with him and try to get as much information out of him as you can. So I wish I did know them on a personal level, because they're winners. They're winners. Whether you like their disposition, whether you like what they say, their personality, both of them have proven through the years that they can take teams and win. And that's the part that I want to find out is, from anybody that can win, what is it that makes them tick?
Well, I'm going to ask you specifically about that, because the current team is ranked either sixth or seventh in the country, depending on who's doing the ranking. How far do you think this team can go?
I don't know. I don't know. We'd love to finish in the upper echelon of the Big 12, and we were picked third in preseason in the Big 12, and that's probably a pretty fair assessment considering we had four returning starters. But who knows? The league is so good this year, and there's a lot of basketball left to be played, and we're just going to hope to keep piling on those wins, get to the NCAA tournament. Let's see what happens.
Kim Mulkey is the head coach of the women's basketball team at Baylor University. With Peter May, she's the author of Won't Back Down, Teams, Dreams, and Family, published by DeCapo Press. She joined me from the studios of KWBU in Waco, Texas. Coach, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks again for having me, and you have a great day now.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Former New York Knicks coach Larry Brown, who described himself as a dead man walking during his final days in New York in the spring of 2006, this week accused the Knicks organization of spying on him when he was the team's coach. Brown, who is now employed by the Philadelphia 76ers, told Philadelphia Magazine that the Knicks always had security people standing close to him at press conferences and, quote, spies throughout the arena. The spying, Brown said, was directed at him. And then he donned a pair of dark glasses, put on a fake mustache, and began speaking in a Norwegian accent.
But people try to understand. He's the last of the secret agents, and he's my man.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a Paralympic powerlifter's preparation for pumping iron in Beijing, he presumes. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Yeah, that was nicely done. You could do this job.
I could.
No doubt about it. We're halfway through the hiatus. We weren't going to go there, and we did. We're halfway through the hiatus between the conference championship games and the Super Bowl. Has anything that's been said, written, rumored, or surmised altered your thoughts about the outcome of next Sunday's game?
No, absolutely not. The New England Patriots are going to win by three touchdowns.
Mm-hmm.
We did.
I will say that next week, by the way, too. Just giving our listeners a preview of next week's Only a Game.
We did get a new perspective on the divisional playoffs and the AFC Championship game on Wednesday, though. That's when San Diego Chargers quarterback Philip Rivers had surgery to repair a torn anterior cruciate ligament in his right knee. What do you suppose Rivers would have done if the Chargers had beaten the Patriots last Sunday?
I think he probably would have played in the Super Bowl, and it would be very interesting and as a kind of speculative exercise to wonder whether or not we'd know about this if they were playing the Giants next week.
And speaking of leg injuries, were you shocked that New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick had nothing whatsoever to say about quarterback Tom Brady's temporarily plastic boot-enclosed foot?
You know, if I thought the New England Patriots were capable of, like, overall, general, simultaneous, spontaneous team whimsy, they should all show up for media day on Tuesday wearing boots.
Perhaps on their heads. The world is divided into two kinds of people, Charlie. Those who can tolerate a football-free weekend in January and those who will watch today's Senior Bowl. Which camp are you in?
Actually, I think the world is divided into two kinds of people. The people who think the world is divided into two kinds of people and smart people. But that having been said,
let me just take this dart out of my head.
I will not be watching the Senior Bowl because it will be nothing but people playing football on a field and commentators talking about various drills they'd done earlier in the week. It's very bizarre. It does not interest me.
Joe Wilfried Tsonga and Novak Djokovic endeared themselves to crowds at the Australian Open by upsetting their much more highly ranked opponents in the men's semifinals. But will anybody care which of them wins the finals?
Well, let us be clear that Monsieur Tsonga is French and is not from an island far away, as you might guess from his name. Tsonga! That having been said, I was very surprised about Federer. I'm not surprised about Rafael Nadal because he's more mercurial. Federer is usually steadier than this, and him not being there is really quite something. I don't know how the people at the Aussie Open feel, but I have a very good feeling that American television executives are not happy here.
It's NHL All-Star Weekend. Charlie, do you suppose that they'll be holding tomorrow's game outside in the aptly named Hotlanta?
No, I don't think so, actually. It's supposed to be 57 degrees. It would be a nice way. Of course, there's a little bit of the gleam off of it because Sidney Crosby can't play. He's injured. It would be cool if they could find an outdoor rink in Atlanta to do it, but I don't think they will.
And speaking of Hotlanta, sales of the new Air Jordan shoe are anything but lukewarm. Can you offer, 23 words about that?
I have no idea why anybody would buy this. Looking at the picture in black and white, they look like a pair of mucklucks I bought for my daughter 8 years ago.
People lined up and slept outside for two nights
A financial analyst, is said in the story, took 2 days off from work to buy these shoes. And he has a collection of 75 pairs of sneakers. And you wonder why the money marketing industry just went in the can this week.
Economy.
Everybody was out waiting for sneakers.
The Miami Heat lost their 15th consecutive game on Thursday. This is pretty much the same team that won the title in 2006. Can you remember as steep a falling off for an NBA champion?
No, not without the retirement of Bill Russell or the retirement of Larry Bird or the retirement of somebody. Pretty plainly, Shaquille O'Neal, the accumulation of wear and tear on him has brought him down to the point where he's really only a part-time player, and Dwayne Wade doesn't have any help. This is really sort of embarrassing.
The men's basketball team representing Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and I said that right, I promise, accomplished two goals on Thursday night while head coach Ron Hunter watched from the sidelines in bare feet. His Jaguars broke a two-game losing streak and helped in an effort to collect over 100,000 pairs of shoes for charity. Not a bad night's work.
No, it's terrific, and I know who I'm rooting for in the first round of the NCAA tournament if they get there now.
Elsewhere in basketball news, Tim Floyd, the men's basketball coach at USC, says if anybody should be punished for USC player O.J. Mayo's attendance at Monday night's Nuggets-Lakers game, courtesy of Nuggets star Carmelo Anthony, it should be Floyd. Mayo's only a freshman. Anthony certainly didn't stay in college long enough to learn the NCAA rules, so maybe Coach Floyd is right.
It's possible he's right. The saga of O.J. Mayo, who is essentially working at the University of Southern California as an independent contractor for a year before he goes on to the NBA.
Or at least a season.
Gets weirder and weirder. This is a guy who essentially recruited himself. He happens to have known Carmelo Anthony since O.J. Mayo was in seventh grade. They don't come from the same part of the country. How in the name of God did O.J. Mayo know Carmelo Anthony when he was in seventh grade? I'll tell you how. He's been in the culture of big-time basketball since he was in the seventh grade. All of this was with the deal when you took O.J. Mayo. Tim Floyd knew that, and I think he's taken the bullet kind of nobly to keep the NCAA off his back for the 4 months.
Maglio Ordonez, who plays the outfield for the Detroit Tigers, said this week that Jose Canseco had said that he would keep Ordonez's name out of Vindicated, Canseco's new book, if Ordonez would invest some money in the movie Canseco was trying to make of his first book, which is Juiced. Is this good or bad publicity for Vindicated?
I think it's terrific publicity for Vindicated, considering that Ordonez chose not to pursue legal action in what is what if it's true, is it a pretty clear-cut case of blackmail. That having been said, I mean, the sudden renaissance of Jose Canseco, bold truth teller, is as nauseating as it is inevitable and as it is hilarious. So I think you'll see a few more of these kind of stories coming out.
If they do make a movie of Juiced, where do they hold the casting call? Venice Beach?
I have no idea.
And finally, Charlie, environmentalists, particularly environmentalists who have no use for sports, have a new villain to revile. What is it exactly that makes David Beckham the scourge of the planet?
Burn it like Beckham. He's got the world's largest carbon footprint, supposedly. It may be the largest in human history. He flew 250,000 miles last year as he went back and forth between Europe and the consumer fraud contract he signed with the LA Galaxy. And, of course, his wife, Victoria Beckham, has modeling and music obligations all over the world. She flew all over the place. He has 15 cars, including a Porsche, a Hummer, and a Lincoln Navigator, and he's not getting a Christmas card from Al Gore.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and, of course, he joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
I first saw Anderson Wise at a gym in Needham, Massachusetts. He was lying on his back on a weight bench to which he had strapped himself with a heavy belt. He may not have been pressing more weight than anybody else in the building, but he was the most exceptional athlete on the gym floor.
Well, in medical terms, I was born with a birth defect called spina bifida. And basically what that means is when I was born, part of my back was open, there was a bubble. Sort of messed up the nerve endings in my spine so that I have some feeling in my legs, but I don't have full sensation, you know, not enough strength to obviously walk.
In the gym that day, Andy Wise was trying to master some new exercises for various small muscle groups in his shoulders and arms.
Sometimes they give a little grunt when I lift, it gives you a little bit of extra push. Grunting is good too, you know. I have my grunting moments, you know. So just depends what kind of mood I'm in, you know. Depends on how my day is going. I'll just leave it at that.
The lifting and the grunting are in service of Wise's longer-term goal, which is to prepare himself for the Paralympic Games in Beijing this summer. He's already competed in the Para Pan Am Games in Brazil and won national championships in his weight class in 2004 and 2006. He can bench press nearly 400 pounds. He begins each training session by driving to the gym in a car that's been equipped with hand controls, lifting his wheelchair out of the car, hauling himself off the seat and into the wheelchair, and rolling into his workout. A workout that is in some ways a continuation of what Wise has been doing for as long as he can remember.
Well, my parents, you know, always treated me just like my other brothers and sisters. You know, my other brothers and sisters slept on the second and third floor, so, hey, you know, I had to figure out a way to get up there myself. They obviously didn't put in an elevator or anything like that. Now I think of it as you know, a really good component that they did that to me, because my upper body, you know, is pretty big now, and part of that it has to do with, you know, having to crawl up the downstairs to where I get to my room every day.
Pretty big is something of an understatement. You look like you're wearing shoulder pads is what you look like.
Well, thank you. I get that all the time from people, you know. They, you know, at first, you know, if I have, you know, a big jacket on or something like that, you know, they, you know, I don't look too big. But then I take, you know, the jacket off and, you know, I'm just, you know, sitting here with a T-shirt on and people, you know, sort of walk by and they're like, oh, my God, he's enormous.
The bulging biceps and rippling pecs are, in fact, enormous. The family of brothers and sisters to which Andy refers is also sizable. Over the years, Andy's adoptive parents, Dale and Sally Wise, have been foster parents to 45 children, many of them with special needs. At their home in Needham a few weeks ago, Sally Wise recalled the beginning of the family's association with Anderson.
Well, we got a phone call. At the time, we were doing foster care. And we got a call on a little boy that was at then Boston City Hospital that had been born with spina bifida and hydrocephalus. At the time, we were doing high-risk special needs foster care, and that probably this little boy would go on to be adopted.
Adoption was the plan because Andy's mother, who had come to the U.S. from Haiti, had no resources with which to deal with his multiple special needs. Sally says that for months, she and Dale, who are white, expected the Huxtables to sweep in and steal Andy away from them, but it didn't happen, and the Wises, who had begun loving Andy from the first day they'd met him, eventually were allowed to adopt him when he was 3 years old.
We always tell him that he's Haitian by heritage, he's American by birth, and he's Irish by absorption.
Yeah, I can see the map of Ireland.
His favorite meal is corned beef.
Wore it down with a pint of Guinness.
Well, Guinness is good for you, right. Exactly. That's all right.
During the years before that menu was an option, it was Sally and Dale who learned how to change the baby's bandages after the multiple surgeries his condition required and how to bring a certain skepticism to the instructions the professionals gave them for Andy's ongoing care.
I read everything the day we brought him home that they gave us, and I said, well, now I've read it, now I'll put it in the drawer, and now we'll just do baby.
According to Dale, that was a strategy from which Sally never strayed as Andy grew.
Andy was in braces, and the doctors wanted Andy to be in long leg braces or in casts. He had night casts to keep his feet because his feet would turn backwards, and they wanted to train the muscles. And they wanted him in braces or casts 23 hours a day. And Sally said, I'm going to let him be a little boy. So Sally, when he got old enough, would crawl around behind him, and she would move his legs, one leg ahead and then the other leg.
So Sally taught Andy to crawl and hustle up the stairs. And then, when Andy was not quite 2 years old, he impressed Dale by hauling himself into the living room and putting one hand on the coffee table and the other on the couch to pull himself off the floor. Dale wondered what the aspiring toddler might be able to do with a set of modified parallel bars, so he built him one. Then one day the physical therapist who visited Andy each week announced that she wanted to work on his abdominal muscles. According to Dale, Andy was ready.
Well, one of the things Andy liked to do, he'd get bored walking from one end of this 6-foot-long parallel bar, he would swing his legs up, and he would sit on them like they were parallel bars at a gym. Or he would sit on the floor and he would chin himself. So I said to the physical therapist, you mean this? And so Andy walked up and flipped over, and then he got to the parallel bars and chinned himself and flipped over. And she said, all right, we don't have to work on his abdominal muscles. We have to work on something else.
The physical therapist was one in a long line of professionals Andy Wise surprised. When Dale and Sally took him home from the hospital, they were told Andy would not only never walk, but because the shunt they'd put in his skull shortly after he was born had probably caused brain damage, he would never talk. Dale and Sally didn't believe it. They talked to him. They played him tapes of nursery rhymes and alphabet songs. He began imitating them, and then he began talking. And sometimes, Dale says, he could be a pretty determined talker.
I got into sled hockey because Andy heard about sled hockey and he wanted to play sled hockey.
How old was he at that point?
He was about 5 years old. And the only place sled hockey was being played was in Minnesota. And he said, well, why can't we go to Minnesota to play sled hockey? I said, Andy, it's almost 2,000 miles. He said, well, why can't we move to Minnesota so I can play hockey?
Eventually, Andy played sled hockey. He played wheelchair basketball, too. The U.S. Paralympic track team asked him to join them, as did the U.S. Paralympic ski team. Instead, Andy concentrated on his education. After graduating from Needham High School, he earned an associate's degree at Mass Bay Community College. He's now pursuing a bachelor's degree at Bridgewater State College, where he's known as a dedicated student, though academics have always been a challenge.
Sort of keeping up with the reading, I'd say, is the most difficult. Pretty slow reader. I have to read things, you know, at least 2 or 3 times to sort of get the whole aspect of what's going on. So sometimes that's difficult for me.
The odds that Andy Wise will deal effectively with that difficulty would seem to be pretty good, given that he wasn't supposed to be able to speak, let alone attend college. But his achievements notwithstanding, a guy who rolls into the gym in a wheelchair and carries a pile of plates on his lap from the rack to the bar still strikes some of the other people in the gym as a guy who needs help. He politely declines their offers.
You know, I sort of feel that, you know, by teaching them that, you know, I can hop on and off the bench by myself, you know, I can pick up the weights by myself,
that they'll learn from that, that, you know, they don't need to always ask me if I need help. Just sort of teaches people that are physically challenged can get around just like people that are able to walk.
So in addition to his other accomplishments, Andy Wise has become a teacher. But his primary focus at this point is on preparing for the Summer Paralympic Games in Beijing. He recently won a competition in Alabama, and his current accomplishments place him among the best powerlifters in his weight class in this country, but he has to impress a higher authority.
You have to be invited by the International Committee in order to attend the Paralympic Games. The U.S. Committee doesn't decide that factor. And so what they do is they calculate your international competition lifts over a two-year span. I'll find out in March whether I qualified to go, which of course I will. So
you're confident?
I'm very confident, yes.
Given the obstacles, this young man, who was supposed to be too weak to get around by himself and too brain damaged to talk, has already overcome. How could it be otherwise? Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our Anderson Wise powerlifting photo gallery or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Baylor head basketball coach Kim Mulkey. I asked her what she had for dinner the night before our conversation.
What did I have for dinner? I don't think I ate anything. We had a game last night, so I probably drank a Powerade and went to bed.
And they won that game. Do you suppose when they lose, it's warm tap water and sleep on the floor? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.